All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Appreciate y'all tuning in today. Our next guest on the show is Stephen M. Walt. He is a professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, previously taught at Princeton and the University of Chicago, was a resident associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the book Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, 2005, and co-author with John J. Mearsheimer of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, both the essay and the book all about it. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing just fine. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. So I guess let's start with the video of Netanyahu that was released over the weekend. I'm sure you saw it and read the transcript and so forth, right?
I haven't seen the video, but I have read about the remarks that were sort of disseminated.
Well, I wonder if you can kind of paint a portrait of what exactly the Oslo Accord was and at what stage they were. I guess what happened was Netanyahu became prime minister in 96 and then just set about a course to undo it, right?
The Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, and it was an agreement between the Palestinians, particularly the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and Israel, essentially done independently, although the United States came in at the last minute. And the Palestinians recognized Israel's right to exist, and the Israelis recognized the PLO as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. And it set out a timetable that was supposed to lead towards the creation of an independent Palestinian community. The Oslo Accords, it's worth noting, do not ever talk about a Palestinian state, although many people believe that's where it was headed. In any case, those negotiations proceeded through the 1990s, but there were several events, mistakes on both sides, I would say on the Israeli and the Palestinian side, that delayed the process. The assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin being an important setback and tragic setback there. And then finally, when Bibi Netanyahu was elected in 96, he had never been a supporter of the Oslo Accords and basically dug in his heels as much as possible to try and prevent that from happening.
And then, I want to finish off the video here before we get into more of the nuts and bolts of the process here. But basically, he's ridiculing the American people for their support for whatever it is he does, and he mocks us.
The video that's come out is a conversation, I believe, in Israel with a community there, and basically explaining how he's not going to allow a two-state solution to occur. But the part that is most incendiary is a series of statements where he basically says, "You don't have to worry about American pressure. You know, that's something we just we can deal with." And I think the key point to understand is sort of twofold. First of all, Netanyahu is basically right. It has been decades since the United States has been willing to put any kind of meaningful or long-lasting pressure on Israel, particularly over the occupation. And secondly, that this policy is not good for the United States, but it's also been quite harmful to Israel as well, because as many Israelis now realize, the occupation has been a disaster for them. Not allowing the creation of a Palestinian state is threatening Israel's long-term future. So the fact that we're unable to act like an honest broker is, in fact, not good for either country, and, of course, not good for the Palestinians either.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is a point you often make on your blog, which I guess I should have pointed out here. It's at foreignpolicy.org, I think it is, right?
Foreignpolicy.com.
Oh, it is .com, foreignpolicy.com. You do point out often that the so-called pro-Israel policy of, for example, the neoconservative movement and the pro-Israel lobby in the United States is the worst policy for Israel, and it has been for quite some time. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, the main problem is that the attempt to create a greater Israel, essentially to colonize the West Bank, has led to a situation now where Israel controls a very large number, 4 to 5 million Palestinians. And over the long term, of course, this threatens Israel's future as a Jewish state. Right? If you either have one choice or the other. Either the Palestinians ultimately get a state of their own on the West Bank and in Gaza, or you will have a situation where virtually, you know, at least half and maybe a majority of the people under Israel's control will not be Jewish and will at the same time not have any political rights, not have the right to vote. About 20% of Israel's current population is Arab. That's Israel prior, you know, within the 67 boundaries, and they do have the right to vote, although they don't exercise much political power at all. But a world in which Israel controls the West Bank in perpetuity is a world in which ultimately they have to either become a multi-ethnic, you know, truly liberal democracy where everybody has the right to vote, in which case it would no longer be a predominantly Jewish state, or they have to continue to deny the Palestinians any political rights, in which case they become an apartheid state. And unfortunately, this sort of unconditional U.S. support and uncritical U.S. support has allowed that situation to continue, thereby threatening Israel's long-term future.
Well, I believe you linked to another blogger last week and an article that he wrote saying it's already too late. Get over it. There's already too many so-called settlements, I guess, colonies in the West Bank, and the army would fall apart before it was able to even get them out of there. And the Bantustans have already been created, the walls have been built, and it's basically a done deal. There never will be a two-state solution. Eventually it will be not just de facto, but an outright one state, single state, and the Jewish character of the state will be destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody actually knows at what point this becomes irreversible. As you say, there are certainly many people, including a few Israelis, some Palestinians, some Americans, Europeans, who think that the moment has already been passed, that we've sort of gone past the point of no return, and that the future over the next, you know, 10 to 20 to 30 years will be a struggle for political rights within Israel itself. The two-state solution is really no longer possible. I don't believe that yet, but I do think we are very rapidly approaching that point of no return. And the question people ought to be thinking about is, you know, what does an American president do at that point? Right now, President Obama or President Bush before him could talk about how they were in favor of a two-state solution, and they say this over and over again. Well, at some point, if we continue in the current course, that won't be possible. That will, you'll sound silly if you say you're in favor of a two-state solution, because everyone will know it's totally unreachable. And the question then becomes, you know, what is American policy? Are we going to support an apartheid state in which nearly half the population is denied political rights? Or are we going to support one person, one vote, which is very consistent with America's political traditions, the idea that, you know, everyone should be considered an equal citizen regardless of their background, regardless of their religion? Now, if you don't want an American president to face that very awkward choice, then you ought to be pushing very hard for a two-state solution if it is, in fact, still possible.
Well, now, can you tell us a little bit about the rights of Israeli Arabs? You know, Arabs who are Muslims or Christians but are citizens of Israel, and how their treatment differs from Jewish Israelis?
Well, first of all, the state is explicitly founded as a Jewish state. Sort of de facto, it is considered by Israelis to be the state of the Jewish people. So in a sense, you've already declared the Arab population to be second-class citizens. It would be as though the United States said, we are a Protestant state, or we are a Christian nation, and then anybody who wasn't would have to sort of walk around knowing that they somehow didn't quite fit in. Israeli Arabs do have the right to vote, and they do. They have the right to form political parties. But for example, and they're about 20% of the population. I believe in the entire history of Israel, there's been one member of an Israeli cabinet who was Arab. So despite the fact that they're 20% of the population, they don't really have much political representation. They certainly don't have 20% of the seats in the Knesset. Moreover, there are all sorts of structural inequalities within Israeli society.
All right, I'm sorry, we're gonna have to hold the rest of that answer, okay, the structural inequalities, till we get back from this break. Everybody, it's Stephen Walt, walt.foreignpolicy.com. We'll be right back after this. I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. My head really hurts. If I don't All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Stephen M. Walt. He writes at foreignpolicy.com. That's walt.foreignpolicy.com. He's the co-author, of course, of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And when we were so rudely interrupted by the commercials there, you were talking about the structural, or you're about to begin discussing the structural differences in how non-Jewish Israeli citizens are treated inside the state of Israel. We're not talking about Gaza and the West Bank now, but in the rest of Israel there.
Right. And as I said, Israeli Arab citizens have the right to vote, participate in politics. But as is often the case with minorities in other societies, they're treated essentially as second-class citizens. They're not allowed to serve in the Israeli Defense Forces, with a couple of exceptions. And because service in the military is, first of all, compulsory for most Israeli citizens and is a route to advancement. It's a way in which you move up in Israeli society that cuts off one obvious route to sort of rising. The school systems are not equal for the Arab citizens and the Israeli citizens. The amount of money devoted to Arab villages, Arab communities, bus service, things like that is unequal as well. And there have been actually several Israeli commissions looking at this who have been quite critical of the performance of the Israeli state in dealing with its own Arab minority. Now, that's still much, much better than the treatment that Palestinian Arabs get in the West Bank and in Gaza, obviously, where they have essentially no political rights whatsoever, and certainly no voice over the policies of the government that is occupying those territories and controlling their lives.
Well, you know, I wonder whether the truth here gets all just mixed up by our point of view. I mean, in a sense, Israel expanded beyond those borders in 1967. The West Bank and Gaza are part of Israel. It already is a one-state solution there. It's just that the people in Gaza and the West Bank don't have any rights. That's all.
Well, and there are a number of people, including many Israelis, who argue essentially that point, that a one-state system of control exists de facto. I think, again, there is still a difference in the status between the occupied territories and Israel proper, the pre-1967 borders. And if there's going to be any hope of a peaceful settlement and reconciliation anytime soon, it will still be along the lines of a two-state solution. The only question is whether or not the two sides can be brought to that, and that brings us to the role of the United States, which is probably the only country with sufficient potential leverage to actually bring something like that about before it's too late.
Well, now tell me this. What is... Can you give us like your nutshell history of the last year and a half of the Obama administration here? Because I got to admit, I'm kind of thrown for a loop. I mean, if he was smart, he would have just done what George Bush and Bill Clinton did, which is wait till the end of his presidency and then, you know, give it his attempt to half measure something. But he came out on this big roll with this big Cairo speech and said, "Nah, I'm determined. We're going to get this done. And we want to freeze on the rate of the growth of the colonies in the West Bank and all this." And then now it seems he is completely and totally backed down.
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization of it. I believe President Obama understood two things when he became president. I think he understood that the perpetuation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was a huge problem for the United States. It undermined our image throughout the Arab and Islamic world, was ultimately not good for Israel's long-term future as well, and that trying to bring that to a close was the right thing to do. I think he genuinely believed that, and of course, I think he was right. And so, you know, it was somewhat encouraging the first 6 months that he appointed, you know, a respected mediator in George Mitchell. He said a number of the right things, culminating in the Cairo speech, and you got the impression that he really meant it. I think in retrospect, it now appears that he and the people advising him were very naive. And they were naive in the following sense. They, I think, believed that if they took a very firm line at the very beginning, the Israeli government, and in particular Prime Minister Netanyahu, would not want to do anything to annoy a very popular U.S. president, and that he would therefore go along. And they never asked themselves the question, what are we going to do if Netanyahu digs his heels in and says no? I don't think they even considered that option. And when that's exactly what Netanyahu did, they suddenly realized they had a fight on their hands, and it was not a fight they were willing to face. particularly when, you know, they only had 60 votes in the Senate. They were trying to get health care through. And I think they began to realize that they could not buck the domestic political support, and in particular the power of various groups in the Israel lobby. And at that point, it's been one retreat after another, which, again, is not good for us, but I would argue not good for Israel either.
Well, and it seems like from the very beginning he was willing to concede to them Iran policy. Look, just let me get some progress going on in the West Bank and Gaza, and I'll go ahead and threaten Iran in whichever form is preferable to Likud.
Well, again, I think that oversimplifies it a little bit. I believe that when they came in, they wanted to open up to Iran, and there were a number of gestures made in the first few months of the administration designed to indicate a greater willingness to negotiate with Iran. Certainly,
that's funny. I'd forgotten all about that.
Right. You know, he sent this broadcast message. And remember, the Bush administration's policy had been not to talk to Iran at all, have no contact whatsoever. And the Obama people, to their credit, say, look, we're willing to talk to them. We'd like to see if we can work this out. And I think they were hoping that the Iranian elections that happened last summer would go a different way, that they'd get a more flexible Iranian government. And, of course, they got the worst of all possible outcomes, a somewhat fraudulent election, domestic disturbances in Iran, which have made the government even more rigid. So that was, I think, a bad break. The problem is that ever since then, they've reverted back to what you might call as a sort of Bush-lite policy, which is attempting to basically ratchet up threats to Iran and repeatedly tell Iran, look, you give us what we want, which is the complete cessation of your nuclear program, and then we'll talk about what you might want. And that's essentially been the U.S. position ever since last summer. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, we've tried that for 10 years, and we know it's not going to work. So we're now back in a position where, you know, people are beginning to talk about using military force again, even though many people recognize that's not going to solve the problem and probably would make things a lot worse. So in a sense, it's mostly been ever since that first few months, a remarkably unimaginative, one might even call sort of almost brain-dead policy, where we're just repeating policies that have failed in the past.
Well, you know, we've been covering the Iran nuclear issue on this show for years and years now, and I one time asked Gareth Porter, look, if everybody in the world, including everybody in Mossad and in Netanyahu's office, knows that there's not really any kind of nuclear weapons program in Iran, then why so paranoid about what's going on at Natanz? And Gareth said he thought that a big part of it was Aliyah, and people are leaving Israel and they're not coming to it. And the idea is not that Iran would strike first with atomic weapons at Israel and then get completely extinct at the hands of Israeli retaliation. It's that people would be afraid to move there. And this population problem in Palestine that we've been referring to, problem from their point of view, you know, would become that much worse. And so that's really what all this is about.
That's true or not. It may be true, and there may be some. In fact, I know there are some Israelis who think along these lines. The point is, of course, that's a completely self-fulfilling problem. The more you talk about it, the more scared you might make people, and the worse the problem becomes.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Stephen M. Walt. You can find his blog at walt.foreignpolicy.com. Of course, he's co-author of the famous book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Now, Stephen, when we went out to break, I had asked you about the motivation or the reason for such Israeli paranoia about Iran's nuclear program and Gareth's idea that it has to do with the willingness of the diaspora to move to Israel.
Yeah, I think the thing to point out is there are lots of different reasons why Israelis would not like Iran to have a nuclear weapons capability. Some of it may be concerns that people won't want to come to Israel or may leave because they'll be scared. Certainly, there's got to be some residual fear that that they might use a weapon. I think that's very unlikely, but certainly we would feel the same way if a country near us was developing nuclear weapons. And also, also, of course, raising that issue is a way of distracting everyone from other things, like the occupation as well. I don't think there's anything nefarious about an Israeli government preferring that Iran not get a nuclear capability. The question is, what do you do in order to try and discourage them from doing that, and how serious a threat is it really? My argument would be that the United States would obviously like it if Iran never got nuclear weapons. We don't know, by the way, if they're actively trying to do so now or not. We know they're trying to control the full fuel cycle, but whether they turn that into a weapons program is another question. The real issue is whether or not you're willing to go to war to prevent that from happening. And there, I think it would be an enormous mistake. And what we ought to be trying is a much more creative set of diplomatic approaches designed to persuade Iran that it is in Iran's best interest not to ever take its nuclear capacity and actually weaponize it. And whether that ultimately gets linked to sort of larger efforts at creating some kind of nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, which would then bring the Israeli nuclear arsenal into play in those negotiations, is, I think, another issue as well. The main problem is that our policy towards Iran in the last 10 years or so has been very unimaginative, and it's not surprising that we haven't gotten anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was the goal of the Hawks, was it not, in the Bush administration, at least, to try to get Iran to marginalize the moderates, to try to get Iran to withdraw from the Nonproliferation Treaty and break their safeguards agreement in the way that the North Koreans did. That's what John Bolton said. It's on YouTube.
I'm not surprised to hear that Ambassador Bolton might have said something like that. I think that early in the Bush administration, certainly about the time that we were going into Iraq, there was a pretty ambitious idea that we were really going to transform the entire region. And, first we'd knock off Saddam Hussein, and then we would turn on Iran and Syria and either threaten them into doing what we wanted or actually engage in more regime change as well. That particular dream, I think, died in the sands of Iraq, but it is quite clear that some of the same groups and same people who dreamed up the idea of going into Iraq in the first place, way back in the late 1990s, are now the loudest voices calling for a very hard line, including the possible use of military force against Iran. I think if you pay attention over the next 6 months or so, you're going to see a very similar kind of campaign being waged to try and persuade people that diplomacy is never going to work, that Iran simply has to be toppled, and that the United States has to be willing to use military force to either destroy their nuclear facilities or, possibly do more. Now, they don't have George Bush in the White House. They don't have Dick Cheney in the vice president's office, and that's going to make it, I think, a harder sell. But there are people in the Obama administration who've been sympathetic to that set of arguments in the past, and it remains to be seen how President Obama and the rest of his government will respond as this campaign begins to ratchet itself up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you base what you say on all these facts that you refer to and stuff about, they're mastering the fuel cycle, but it remains to be seen whether they're trying to make nuclear weapons or not, that kind of thing. And yet that's not really how the discussion about this issue goes on in the media. Even when the NIE came out in 2007 and it kind of stopped the war party in their tracks, at least for TV purposes, it only lasted 2 or 3 months, and we're right back to the Iranians are making nuclear weapons again.
Right. Well, there's an enormous amount of disinformation goes on there, and none of us know for 100% certainty what Iran is doing. The question you want to ask yourself is, first of all, what's the most promising strategy for persuading Iran not to go down the nuclear weapons road, not to ever test them, develop them, build a big arsenal, etc.? And there may be ways to do that, none of which we really have explored, I think, very carefully. The main point I'd make there is if you're trying to persuade someone not to get nuclear weapons, continually threatening them, including threatening them with regime change, is not the way to do it. The only way you'll persuade them to not go down the nuclear road is if they feel reasonably secure, feel like the United States isn't going to come after them. The second thing, of course, is if they were to go down that road, you have to ask yourself, is a preventive war the best way to deal with that, or is reliance on deterrence the same way we relied upon it against the Soviet Union and others in the past? recognizing, among other things, that Israel itself has several hundred nuclear weapons, and an Iranian leader could never order an attack on Israel or any other close U.S. ally without endangering his entire country and his own life. I don't think deterrence is an ideal strategy, but I think it's a better strategy than preventive war.
All right, well, I know I'm in the fringe on this, but what about just giving them a security guarantee and making friends? Like when Dick Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton in the 1990s, and he committed the treason of going overseas to criticize his own government and said, Bill Clinton and these unreasonable sanctions, this has got to end. I'm trying to do business here. What if we were just friends with the Iranians? No hard feelings.
Well, I think that should be our long-term objective. I think if we're realistic about it, given the history of U.S.-Iranian relations and all of the bad blood and misunderstanding going back now decades, it's naive to think you can turn that around in a month or 6 months or even a year. What we ought to be doing, though, is looking for opportunities to do that, and certainly not doing anything that will make that harder to do down the road. There are actually many issues, including, you know, counterterrorism, including al-Qaeda, including stabilizing Afghanistan, where the United States and Iran have very similar interests. And, you know, again, I don't think anyone should be naive about how easy it will be to unwind that spiral of hostility and suspicion. But I do think it's possible. And the problem is we're not being very creative in finding ways to do that. We're actually making things worse progressively.
Mm. Well, it seems like the case could be made that, look, the Iranians have been our best allies in fighting the Iraq war since 2003. That's a pretty good plus in their book, isn't it? Or have we been helping them fight it?
I think that, again, that oversimplifies it a little bit. The Iran has probably done some things that undermine our effort in Iraq and have done some things to help as well. They have not exploited it as much as they might have. They certainly were very helpful to the United States back in 2001, 2002, after 9/11, both condemning the attack, but also giving us active help when we went into Afghanistan after the Taliban and after al-Qaeda. And there was actually, I think, several opportunities there where we might have built upon those gestures of friendship. I might add that this is before Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the current president, was even elected. And I think a good case can be made that he might never have been elected had we responded differently back in that early period. Now it's going to be even tougher to unwind things, but the way to do that is not by continuing to threaten them with regime change, being only willing to talk with them in the most sort of narrow ways. And ultimately, I think it would depend on, as you were suggesting, providing some sort of assurances to Iran that we're no longer trying to overthrow their government. We're not actively engaged in, you know, efforts to sabotage things inside Iran, and that we're eager to sort of move past the bad relations of the past and build something more constructive. That's going to require some movement on their part, too.
Right. Okay, now hold on just 1 second. Is it okay if I push it and try to keep you one more segment here, Stephen?
Okay, one more.
Okay, excellent. Everybody, it's Stephen M. Walt. That's walt.foreignpolicy.com, and down at your local bookstore, it's the Israel Lobby.
It's all live from baseball, the Apple Pie to Bomb. Waco, Texas, Heaven's Gate, the Oklahoma Bomb. The Desert Storm Syndrome experiment that went wrong. Inject our own, cause they probably won't come.
All right, y'all. We're wrapping up Anti-War Radio for the day. I'm Scott Horton. Check out lrn.fm, antiwar.com/radio. And also walt.foreignpolicy.com. That's the blog of our guest, Stephen M. Walt. He's a professor of international affairs at Harvard, is the co-author of the book and the essay, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy with John J. Mearsheimer. And now we were talking about Iran, and these hard breaks are pretty inconvenient sometimes, but you were saying that, you know, it was, well, I guess, first of all, it was oversimplification for me to say that the Iranians have been our best allies in Iraq this whole time. But then again, it's not that much of an oversimplification, considering that our war has been to install the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and Muqtada al-Sadr in power. At least we've been fighting for them if they haven't been fighting for us there, huh?
Well, again, I think it actually what it shows is what a boneheaded decision it was to go into Iraq in the first place. Certainly the goal of the United States was not to install a series of leaders who were very sympathetic to Iran. I mean, our policy up until then had been to be very hostile to both Iraq and Iran. And certainly when, George Bush ordered the troops in, he was not doing that because he thought he was going to do Tehran a big favor. I think one of the ways in which we see what a mistake that war was is the fact that we ended up improving the strategic position of the other main adversary we had in the region. And that was, again, because the people who dreamed that up, didn't understand the regional politics very well, were very cavalier in how easy it would be to knock off Saddam and put in place a pro-American government. And that's, of course, not what happened. But I don't think one can argue that we did it in order to help the Iranians.
Oh, no, I just meant, in effect.
Well, in effect, yes. But again, it wasn't our goal. I mean,
Bush at some point said, look, I prefer Abdulaziz al-Hakim to Muqtada al-Sadr because that was his choice. And Abdulaziz al-Hakim had been in exile in Iran for 30 years.
Right. And again, because we ended up in a situation where we didn't have any good choices. And have been forced to try and make the best of it ever since. I think the larger point, though, is that the United States is going to have to find ways to start dealing with Iran as it is and try and hope that the democratic impulses that do exist, and I think are actually quite powerful within Iran, ultimately do come to the fore. There's actually quite an interesting book recently published by Stephen Kinzer, who's an award-winning journalist formerly with the New York Times, and arguing that over the longer term, not again in the next 6 months or so, but over the longer term, the United States should be trying to build very constructive and positive relations with both Iran and also with Turkey, because these are countries in the Muslim world that do have strong democratic traditions, have been pursuing democracy now for a century or so, unlike some other countries in that part of the world. And therefore, we have to start thinking much more creatively about how to get past all of the differences between ourselves and Iran and move in a much more constructive direction going forward. And again, if I faulted the Obama administration on this one, as I said before, it's primarily because after some initial gestures, they have fallen back on a set of approaches towards Iran that have never worked in the past and are unlikely to work in the future.
Now, when you talk about Iraq and all of this, the neoconservative movement, it all comes back to the Israel lobby. I don't know if you'd agree with this, but Andrew Coburn said that he defined the neoconservative movement, not so much as former leftists and Democrats who became right-wingers so much as this is where the Israel lobby crosses with the military-industrial complex. And, basically the Lockheed and Northrop Grumman and all those companies needed to hire some intellectuals to come up with excuses for selling their weapons. And so they made this kind of mob marriage with the neocons back in the 70s. And so we have this, immense power behind this neoconservative movement. It seems like a lot of the positions that you're taking and explaining in a very reasonable fashion here on this show today are mostly not even really part of the discussion in D.C., at least as far as I can tell. It seems like Bill Kristol gets to decide the terms of every debate.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate Mr. Kristol's power, but he's obviously a very influential figure. And the most disturbing thing about the sort of role of neoconservatives is the complete lack of accountability. You would think that the architects of the Iraq War, and neoconservatives really were, they were the first people to talk repeatedly about the need to go to war in Iraq, and this began in the mid to late 1990s. These are the guys who dreamed up this whole idea. And you would think that given the results of Iraq, a costly, protracted, disastrous war for the United States, you would think that no one would be taking them very seriously at all. But in fact, because there is, in fact, very little accountability in the sort of inside the Beltway establishment, they are continuing to be, on talk shows and have their journals of opinion and op-ed columns and, forming new organizations, having founded old committees and projects and groups to try and advocate for war with Iraq. We now see the same people, same tactics being used to try and push the United States into a war with Iran. As I said, a half hour or so ago, they don't have quite as sympathetic an environment And certainly the 9/11 attacks certainly helped the cause, although they had to do an awful lot of distortion to exploit that. But nonetheless, they're trying to do the same things now, and it's really remarkable given the track record that they've had so far.
Well, a major part of this is brought to kind of the forefront with the new Emergency Committee for Israel. One of the prime members of it with Bill Kristol is Gary Bauer from the right-wing side, the religious right, I guess, the Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, John Hagee style of right-wing Protestantism. And I wonder if you could give us any kind of ballpark estimates to how many millions of people count as that part of the Israel lobby, you think?
I actually think it's a much smaller number than people believe. You often hear the number, you know, sort of 40 million people in the evangelical movement, but the vast majority of them do not place the same priority on a sort of hardline pro-Israel position. Some of them do, and they are, you know, they have some political weight. They certainly help within the Republican Party, for example. I think in terms of our policy vis-a-vis Israel, still groups like AIPAC, the Conference of Presidents, and some others have more clout on Capitol Hill, have more influence in Washington. Think tanks like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, American Enterprise Institute, now the Sabin Center at Brookings, I think have more influence within Washington circles than the sort of Gary Bauer Christian Zionist groups. But they're not trivial, and they certainly do broaden the base of groups that want the United States to back Israel no matter what it does, and in particular want the United States to oppose any kind of two-state solution. In the case of Christian Zionists, it's based on their interpretation of Old Testament prophecy. And I've never thought the Old Testament was a particularly good guide to American foreign policy, whatever its merits as a religious document might be.
Well, now, in your book, Professor Mearsheimer and yourself, and again, it's the Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, in here you make it very clear that it's perfectly legitimate for people to be lobbyists, for Americans to be lobbyists in favor of other countries that they like and what have you. And that sounds fair enough to me, as long as we have a democracy and all that. But it seems like, as you guys really, it's the subject of your book, the balance of power is pretty out of whack when this tiny little country really has just an absolutely inordinate amount of influence over our government and on issues where it seems pretty apparent, like when we're talking about Iran here. But this isn't in the interest of anybody in America, never mind Israel.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I mean, certainly it's, as you just said, it's completely legitimate for Americans to have a strong attachment to other countries, whatever that country might be, whether it's Poland or Israel or, you know, Pakistan or India or Greece, whatever. We're a melting pot society and lots of people have ties in lots of different places and they can manifest those ties and attachments in our political system. It is, however, a bad thing if the influence becomes so great that you really can't even have a discussion about it, if it's almost becomes reflexive, and if politicians and others are scared or intimidated from voicing any questions, raising any doubts about it. But secondly, it's also just not good for either the United States or for these other countries. We're now in a position where you can't even have an honest discussion about it. If President Obama says anything critical about President or Prime Minister Netanyahu, he immediately gets a storm of criticism, lots of phone calls, things like that. And it's not good if the United States cannot tell its friends, its allies, when they are making mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes, and you want your friends to be able to help you correct them when you do. And we're now in a situation where even when Israel is doing something that's not good for us, but also not good for itself, American politicians can't even say that because, again, these groups in the lobby have wielded such power within our political system.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as anybody who saw when the article and then the book came out, you suffered the brunt of this criticism and every kind of accusation about your character that could be made. You know, congratulations to you for bearing through that and standing by your positions there. But so is there any progress being made? I mean, it seems like Jeez. Well, like you said before, it seems like the neocons really overplayed their hand with Iraq. That would have discredited them. Are we ever going to get to the point where it's not anti-Semitic, quote unquote, to say, hey, America's interests are different than Israel's and we ought to take care of ourselves? They can take care of themselves fine, especially with all the weapons we already bought them.
Well, I think there's some good news here. There is, I think, a more open discussion on this subject than there was back when we wrote our original article. I think that we helped kick that door a little bit open. I think the advent of the Internet has made a big difference in sort of opening up the discussion. And I do think the accusation that anyone who is critical of Israeli policy, things that they're doing, or thinks the United States should have a more normal relationship with Israel rather than this very odd, special relationship we have. The accusation that those people are always just reflexively anti-Semitic is no longer has quite the same power that it did, and that's a good thing. Anti-Semitism itself is a very bad thing, and it ought to be condemned, but not honest discussion, not honest criticism of policy. I think that accusation is losing some of its power to intimidate. That's the good news. The bad news is that the influence of these groups is still pretty profound. Politicians are still very scared of them. President Obama, I think, understood that he couldn't take it on and not get into real trouble on fundraising and in other ways as well. And that means that American policy hasn't shifted yet. So we're getting a more open discussion, but we've still got a ways to go before we have a policy that would be better for the country and for our friends.
All right, everybody, that is Stephen M. Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He writes the blog at walt.foreignpolicy.com and, of course, is the co-author of the article and the book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy with John J. Mearsheimer. Thank you so much for your time on the show today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.